This is Harv Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast, and when I start my workday, it always begins with that morning shower. Normally, I use a liquid body wash, but recently I purchased a bar of Sterling Soap Company's handcrafted bath soap and decided to give their Deep Blue Sea handcrafted bath soap a try. Immediately, the aroma of Sterling's bath soap was obvious, and in using this soap, I felt refreshed, clean, energized, and Sterling's bath soap helped me step out of that shower with the momentum and eagerness to get my day rolling. If you want to get a refreshing wake-up call in the morning and get your busy day off to the right start, I highly recommend going to Sterling Soap Company's website and order one of their many varieties of bath soaps among other products they offer. Visit Sterling Soap Company at sterlingsoap.com. That's STIRLINGsoap.com.
This is Craig Colquitt, former punter for the University of Tennessee Volunteers and the Pittsburgh Steelers, and you are listening to Total Sports Recall Podcast, a part of Sports History Network. Now, here is your host, Harv Aronson.
Welcome to the Total Sports Recall Podcast. I am your host, Harv Aronson, and on this episode, professional football is the topic. I am focusing on three leagues that competed with the National Football League and lost. Lost in the sense that they no longer exist. Extinct. Kaput. We still do have the United States Football League currently playing games, and that league was a spinoff of the former XFL that wrestling icon Vince McMahon created. But looking back in history, there were two of these three leagues that attempted to rival the NFL, and one that tried to partner with the Pro Football League that has been around for many decades, dating back to the early 1900s. First and foremost was the World Football League, created 53 years ago in 1973. A year later, they fielded their first 15 teams in that season, and in 1975, four more teams were added to the league. The teams were as follows: the Birmingham Blade Americans in 1974, the Florida Blazers that same season, 1974, Chicago Fire, Jacksonville Sharks, Portland Storm, the Houston Texans, which was also known as the Shreveport Steamer, the Detroit Wheels, New York Stars, who became the Charlotte Stars, the San Antonio Wings, Jacksonville Express, Portland Thunder, Birmingham Vulcans, Chicago Winds, Philadelphia Bell, Southern California Sun, the Hawaiians, Charlotte Hornets, Memphis Southmen, and the Shreveport Steamer. All these teams competed in the league in 1974 and 1975. After one full season, the WFL folded halfway through the season in 1975. In their only full season in 1974, the league's only champion was crowned, and it was the Birmingham Americans. Credit for the creation of the league goes to Gary Davidson, an attorney from California and businessman, and for investors in the league, he persuaded Robert Schmertz, owner of the World Hockey Association, New England Whalers, and the Boston Celtics, Howard Baldwin, who would go on to own the Pittsburgh Penguins, Ben Haskin, owner of the Winnipeg Jets, and Steve Arnold, a WHA associate. Additionally, John Bassett, a movie producer from Canada, joined the team that became known as the Founding Fathers. In 1974, not just the NFL, but the Canadian Football League's players' associations both had issues with salaries. Of the four major sports in the United States, the NFL had the lowest average salaries, so the WFL offered higher salaries in an effort to get established NFL players to come over to the WFL. The ploy worked when, incredibly, three players from the Miami Dolphins led the NFL left the NFL for the WFL. The newly formed Toronto Northmen signed Larry Zonka, Jim Kick, and Paul Warfield to a contract. Other established veteran players jumping ship were Calvin Hill, Craig Morton, John Gilliam, Ted Qualick, and John Wilbur. As of June 1974, nearly 60 players that had been playing in the NFL signed contracts with the teams in the WFL. However, many of the contracts were future contracts, meaning the players would play out their NFL contracts and then play in the World Football League. But with the league folding in 1975, many of those contracts were never fulfilled. Crazy as it may seem, the WFL played a 20-game schedule in 1974, and there was no preseason. By early June 1974, the WFL claimed that they had some 60 NFL players under contract. Many of these defections came in the form of futures contracts. The players would play out their existing deals with the NFL, then jump to the WFL when those deals expired. Thus, Stabler planned to stay with the Raiders through 1975, then would have joined Birmingham in 1976 had the team and the league survived that long. One novel idea the league carried out was playing 20 games in 19 weeks and did so by playing double games, one on Monday and the other on Friday. Like the NFL, the WFL held their version of a collegiate draft. Unbelievably, the WFL held a 36-round draft. The inaugural World Football Draft had Kansas Jayhawk quarterback David Janes as its first ever overall first player pick. He was drafted by the Memphis franchise, which became the Houston Texans, ironically a team that's playing in the NFL these days. When the season kicked off in 1974, the WFL achieved some impressive attendance figures, averaging nearly 43,000 per game. Then a scandal was made known as the Philadelphia Bell acknowledged that 100,198 tickets had either been given away or sold at reduced prices. The Jacksonville Sharks pulled the same stunt. After just six games of their very first season, teams began to find themselves in financial straits. City moves were being planned. Organizers of the league and owners underestimated what it takes to run a league and a franchise, and there were multiple problems with most of the teams and managing the league. In an embarrassing situation, a game in Philadelphia resulted in players discovering there were no medical supplies, including tape, available, and players therefore refused to play the game. In the second season, Jacksonville was scheduled to be the site of the league title game, right here where I now live, but the league folded and the game never came to be. Some of the financial numbers made public were the Hawaiians team losing $3.2 million and the New York Stars, also known as the Charlotte Hornets, accumulated a debt of over $2 million. As a Pittsburgh Steelers fan, LC Greenwood had signed on with the WFL, but he was able to get out of his contract. So were Ken Stabler and Craig Morton. With the league folding, veterans George Sauer Jr., Leroy Kelly, and Don Maynard retired rather than returning to the NFL. Among the coaches that were leading the World Football League team, several went on to success stories in the NFL. Examples are Jack Pardee, Lindy Infante, and Marty Schottenheimer. Jim Fassel was a former quarterback playing for the Hawaiians and would become a head coach with the New York Giants, leading them to the Super Bowl in 2001. He would later lead the Las Vegas Locomotives to a league title in the United Football League. Some WFL players are in the Pro Football Hall. I mean, there are just four of those: Larry Zonka, Paul Warfield, Leroy Kelly, and Don Maynard. Of course, their induction was based on their careers in the NFL. Some of the more notable jumpers from the NFL to the WFL included Jethro Pugh, a defensive tackle who played with the Dallas Cowboys; Rayfield Wright, also with the Cowboys, played tackle; Virgil Carter, quarterback of the San Diego Chargers; Bob McKay, a tackle with the Cleveland Browns; Bill Berge, very good linebacker with the Cincinnati Bengals; John Gilliam, a wide receiver for the Minnesota Vikings; Calvin Hill, outstanding running back for the Dallas Cowboys; Ted Qualick, tight end for the San Francisco 49ers; Fair Hooker, a wide receiver with Cleveland Browns; and another one of my Pittsburgh Steelers, John Frenchie Fuqua. He also played in the World Football League. Jerry Philbin, defensive tackle, New York Jets; Curly Culp, defensive tackle, Houston Oilers; and finally, Daryl LaMonica, quarterback of the Oakland Raiders. The stadiums these teams played in were as follows: Legion Field in Birmingham, Soldier Field in Chicago, Reinerson Stadium, Citrus Bowl in Orlando, the Alamo Stadium in San Antonio, Honolulu Stadium, Oahu Stadium in Honolulu, the Astrodome in Houston, State Fair Stadium in Shreveport, the Gator Bowl Stadium in Jacksonville, Liberty Bowl Stadium in Memphis, Downing Stadium in New York, American Legion Memorial Stadium in Charlotte, John F. Kennedy Stadium in Philadelphia, Franklin Field in Philadelphia, Civic Stadium in Portland, Anaheim Stadium in Anaheim. And what made the WFL even a bit more bizarre was that they used a football that was orange in color so as to make it more visible for night games. Then there are the touchdowns scored. There was no extra point after touchdown attempts. Instead of all scores were for 7 points, thus no need for the PAT. On pass plays, receivers were required to have just 1 foot in bounds. Even more, on punts, the returners were not permitted to call for a fair catch, but defenders could not get within 5 yards of the returner until the ball was fielded. The World Football League, in its first season, also had games scheduled midweek on Wednesday, but also played on Thursday night, as the NFL does now. In its 2 seasons, the WFL had 2 commissioners, Gary Davidson, until the end of the season in 1974, and then was replaced by Christopher Henmeter. The second pro league to speak of was the United States Football League. President Donald Trump had a hand in this league as part owner of the New Jersey Generals, and Trump had this grand idea that with the USFL, it would force the NFL to adopt his league's teams and create a merger. Almost identical to the World Football League in a lifespan, the USFL lasted an additional season playing games from 1983 to 1985 before closing shop. There were plans for a 4th season in 1986 and were all set to compete against the NFL head-to-head, but they folded before that could happen. 18 teams made up this league, and in 1985, the Baltimore Stars were crowned league champions. The idea for the new league came from the mind of David Dixon, a New Orleans businessman, and he was believed by playing games in the summer, it would give fans an opportunity to see football virtually year-round. Dixon had a hand in the building of the Louisiana Superdome and helped in getting a team in New Orleans, thus they were the Saints. The USFL got off to a rocky start with issues arising centering around the use of NFL stadiums, where the older league made it difficult for USFL owners to secure already used stadiums. Cities sharing an NFL stadium had owners then having to find different venues or moving their team somewhere else. With no salary cap, owners were miscalculating budgets. The league attempted, as the WFL did, to attract NFL players, and without a salary cap, some teams were at an immediate disadvantage in trying to compete for good players. Still, teams fielded players that would go on to careers in the NFL and coaches that have been there. This included some executives as well. Prior to Baltimore winning their first USFL championship, the Philadelphia Stars and Michigan Panthers had preceded them. What made this league a bad joke is that the fact that while encouraged by President Trump to move to a fall schedule in 1986 up against the NFL, the league had also filed an antitrust suit against the National Football League, and it went to trial. A jury heard the case and ruled in the favor of the USFL, indicating the NFL had violated anti-monopoly laws, and the judgment was a hefty $1 to the new league. Because of the antitrust laws, which require tripling of the award, Trump and his league were awarded a hefty $3. This was the nail in the coffin for the USFL, and they never played another season. Estimates of losses for the league are said to be over $163 million. Just as the WFL did, the USFL was able to attract some talented players, immediately coming out of college at their alma maters and signing with the USFL, were Heisman Trophy recipients Herschel Walker, Doug Flutie, and Mike Rozier. They signed with the New Jersey Generals and Rozier with the Pittsburgh Maulers. Pro Football Hall of Fame inductee Reggie White went to the USFL, as did Gary Zimmerman, Jim Kelly, Steve Young, Sam Mills, and former Steelers quarterback Cliff Stout, who was a USFL. As for Herschel Walker, who is an incredibly talented running back, in his first season, he rushed for 1,812 yards and 17 touchdowns. But the New Jersey Generals, who he played for, won just 6 games. Another team that failed to win a lot of games were the Denver Gold. Despite a 7-11 record to begin their entry to the new league, they averaged 41,736 fans for home games. Famous for his post-game speeches, former Colts head coach Jim Mora, who is well-remembered for one single line, "We just want to win a game." Mora was the coach of the Philadelphia Stars, who finished that first USFL season with a record of 15-3. They would lose the league title game to the Michigan Panthers 24-22, but were led by quarterback Chuck Pusina and on defense linebacker Sam Mills. As I hail from Pittsburgh, and I'm a graduate of North Hills High School, the USFL's Michigan Panthers signed fellow alumnus from North Hills and former Steeler Tom Dornberry contract. They also added another Steelers player, Ray Penny and John Banaszak. Despite lasting just three seasons, the 1983 USFL season had to be considered a success when the average attendance at games was around 25,000. The television ratings came out with a Nielsen rating of 6.1, going above league officials' expectations of 5.0. A documentary arose titled Small Potatoes, Who Killed the USFL? After folding its tents in 1986, 36 years later, in 2022, the USFL announced its return to the field with 8 teams and a television deal with Fox Sports. But a year later, the return of the league was made official by merging with the XFL, and the league had a new name, the United Football League. 9 players and coaches or executives that were a part of the USFL find themselves today as members of the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and there's Sid Gilman, Bill Polian, George Allen, Mark Levy, Jim Kelly, Sam Mills, Reggie White, Steve Young, and Gary Zimmerman. As for awards in the short-lived league, the Most Valuable Player Award went to Kelvin Bryant, Jim Kelly, and Herschel Walker. If stats make you curious, here are some of the preseason leaders. Rushing attempts was Herschel Walker with 1,143. Rushing yards, Herschel Walker again, 5,562 yards. Rushing touchdowns, again Herschel Walker, who scored 54 times. Receiving catches, 234 receptions by Jim Smith. Receiving yards, again Jim Smith, 3,685. And again Jim Smith receiving touchdowns when he scored 31. Passing attempts was by John Reeves, who threw 1,352 attempts, and he also led in passing completions with 766. Passing yards was Bobby Herbert, 10,039 yards. And passing touchdowns, Jim Kelly, 83. Passing interceptions, Bobby Herbert threw 57 of those. These are the teams of the USFL, the Arizona Wranglers. And in 1984, Arizona and Chicago traded some players, the Arizona Outlaws, as a result of the Arizona-Oklahoma merger, Birmingham Stallions, the Boston Breakers, the New Orleans Breakers, after moving from Boston, the Portland Breakers, who moved from New Orleans, Chicago Blitz, and Arizona and Chicago, again, traded players there, Denver Gold, Houston Gamblers, Jacksonville Bulls, Los Angeles Express, the Memphis Showboats, Michigan Panthers, who merged with Oakland for the 1985 season, New Jersey Generals, the Oakland Invaders, and they merged with Michigan for the 1985 season, the Oklahoma Outlaws, the Philadelphia Stars, the Baltimore Stars after moving from Philly, the Pittsburgh Maulers, who only played one season, 1984, the San Antonio Gunslingers, Tampa Bay Bandits, the Washington Federals, and the Orlando Renegades, who moved from Washington. And those were the teams that made up the USFL. Had the 1986 season been played, the divisional breakdowns would have been in the Independence Division, the Arizona Outlaws, Jacksonville Bulls, Orlando Renegades, and the Tampa Bay Bandits. And then the Liberty Division, which would have been playing in 1986, was the Baltimore Stars, the Birmingham Stallions, Memphis Showboats, and the New Jersey Generals. And then one final trivia note on the USFL. Much like the Stanley Cup in hockey and the Grey Cup in Canada in the Canadian Football League, the USFL's championship trophy was on loan each year of its existence until a new champion was crowned. So with the Philadelphia Baltimore Stars winning the title in 1985, the general manager of that team, Carl Peterson, handed over the trophy to the Pro Football Hall of Fame, but that didn't happen until 2018. Finally, we have NFL Europe. Now, unlike the two previous leagues, NFL Europe was, for the most part, not competing within the NFL, but rather serving as a proving ground for players in an attempt to show they belong in the NFL. Many National League football coaches and general managers sent their players overseas to see if they had what it takes to be on their respective roster. The league began in 1989 and was called at that time the World League of American Football, or WLAF, for short. The league was not limited to teams just in Europe. North America was also included. Play began in 1991 with 7 teams from the North America and 3 from Europe. The European fans loved the game, but in North America, the league did not fare so well. After 2 seasons, the league went on a hiatus for 2 years. Then it made its return with teams calling in England, Germany, the Netherlands, Scotland, and Spain home. When 2007 NFL Europe ceased operations, the reasons were due to a continuous unprofitability and the National Football League making the decision to host their own regular season games in Europe. When NFL Europe shut its doors, there were 5 teams from Germany and 1 calling the Netherlands its home city, hometown. After a 2-year hiatus, it returned as a 6-team European league with teams based in England, Germany, the Netherlands, Scotland, and Spain. NFL Europa was dissolved in 2007 due to its continued unprofitability and the NFL's decision to shift its focus towards hosting a regular season game in Europe. At the time of its closure, the league consisted of 5 German teams and 1 team based in the Netherlands. Through the years, there were 6 teams in the league from 1995 through 2007 and from 1991 through 1992. It had increased to 10. Countries represented in the years in the league with staging games were the United States, Canada, Germany, the Netherlands, Spain, and the United Kingdom. The league did hold championship games, and the Hamburg Sea Devils were the last of the champions, with the Frankfurt Galaxy winning the most titles, which were 4. The Galaxy is also the only team to play in all 15 seasons, making up the league history. The most popular sports in Europe are soccer and rugby, and NFL Europe incorporated a rule that required local players to be signed to rosters. That made the league interesting in the fact that these locals did not have the American football experience the United States players did. Many of the European players either moved into positions on offensive lines or as punters or place kickers. Some notable NFL players that made the trip overseas to suit up included Brad Johnson, Kurt Warner, Jake Delhomme, Adam Vinatieri, and Dante Hall. The idea of a league in Europe was originally planned in 1974 and was to be called the Intercontinental Football League, or the IFL. 6 teams were proposed in Istanbul, Rome, Munich, West Berlin, Vienna, and Barcelona. Bob Kay founded the idea and had sold 6 franchises, as well as securing rights of some NFL players. Unfortunately, because of the forthcoming World Football League and a players' strike in 1974, as well as the existing recession, prevented the IFL from opening its doors. With the Europe in turmoil at that time and several political issues, the United States State Department convinced then NFL Commissioner Pete Rozelle not to move forward with a new league. By the year 1980, the original European fans that loved the game of football were clamoring for more. The NFL noticed this and began to hold bowl games, as they were called, but actually exhibition games overseas. London became a popular landing spot for these games, and 9 years later, the National Football League officially announced that a spring international league would be developed. The name of the league was going to be the International Football League, but none other than President Donald Trump and Oakland A's owner Charlie Finley had already owned the name. Initially, the league was called World League of American Football, WLAF, taking it from the now-defunct World Football League. While it appeared to be a minor league of sports, representatives from the NFL and WLAF refused to declare the league a minor league. The NFL officially approved the league in 1989, with Tex Schramm heading up the European Football Project. Play was to begin in 1990, or at least by 1991. Initially, 12 teams were proposed, with 6 from the United States and another 4 in Europe, and then 1 each from Canada and Mexico. A television contract was signed with ABC, as well as with the USA Network. But Schramm was fired in October 1990, after differences between he and the NFL had developed, pertaining to the direction the new league would take. Reportedly, Schramm had wanted to the WAF, WLAF, to become independent and a major international league that could function on its own. But the NFL's object was for it to be a small organization with close ties to the mothership. Play was set to begin in 1991 with 10 teams in the field that would be organized into three divisions called North America West, West North American East, and Europe. 50 games were on the schedule, starting with the opener on March 23, 1991, to conclude on May 27, 1991. The league did hold a draft that extended from February 14, 1991 to February 24. Different from the NFL draft, NFL Europe instead made picks position by position, and eligible players were split into 10 position groups. Base salaries for the draftees were set at $20,000, but performance incentives could be included, and a cap was set on salaries at $100,000. After just one season, the league had lost close to $7 million. Television ratings suffered. Fans' attendance averaged only around 26,000. Still, Europeans that were following the league raved about it. In London, their team, the Monarchs, averaged 45,000 per game. Over here in the United States, not many football fans were paying any attention to the league across the pond. The end result was a suspension of play for both the 1993 and 1994 seasons. In 1995, it came back with six teams, fielding all three original European teams, and also had Birmingham Fire returning as the Rhein Fire, calling Dusseldorf home. The Amsterdam Admirals and Scottish Claymores joined the mix. Fox Television joined in as a co-owner, and the league got a new name, this time NFL Europe League, that came about in 1998. The London Monarchs became known as the England Monarchs, but the next year the franchise folded, and in their place came the Berlin Thunder. By 2002, the league had reached its 10th season, but was still not making a lot of money. The Barcelona Dragons closed shop after the 2003 season, as they saw their attendance dwindle to under 7,000 per game. Their spot was snatched up by the Cologne Centurions in 2004, but a year later the Scottish Claymores closed shop. Again, one team goes down and another comes in, and this time it was the Hamburg Sea Devils. Now the league had all German teams with the exception of the Amsterdam Admirals. The funeral for the NFL Europe came on June 29, 2007, just a week after their final championship game, World Bowl 15. The NFL reported the league was losing around $30 million a year, so the National Football League decided to hold their own regular season games several times in Europe and other countries. So those teams that made up the World Football League in Europe were the Barcelona Dragons, the Frankfurt Galaxy, London Monarchs, the Montreal Machine, New York, New Jersey Knights. That was in the Europe division, even though Canada is not Europe. In the North America East division would have been the Ohio Glory, Orlando Thunder, the Raleigh-Durham Skyhawks, and the Birmingham Fire. And then finally, in North America West, we had San Antonio Riders and the Sacramento Surge. Other teams that played later on were the Amsterdam Admirals, the Barcelona Dragons, the Berlin Thunder, the Cologne Centurions, the Frankfurt Galaxy, Hamburg Sea Devils, London, England Monarchs, the Rhein Fire, and the Scottish Claymores. So as indicated, the United Football League is currently playing games, but the question is, how long can they sustain this league? As you see, leagues have come and gone, and that does not include the Arena Football League, which is far different from normal football, and while still around, has had a struggle and is still in existence, but a far cry from a solid and successful league. At one time, there is a women's tackle football league that has nothing to do with the NFL, and I believe they're still playing. The National Football League reigns supreme, and any businessman or businessmen out there that think they can challenge the NFL with a new league might as well forget it. The NFL is a monopoly, and the NFL is the most watched American sport, and fans love every aspect of it, as it offers at least a little something all year round, even when the season is not in session. That's going to conclude this podcast, and next up in a few weeks will be a podcast spotlighting some of the greatest sports speeches in history. Until then, as always, Much thanks to the Sports History Network for hosting this podcast and to the SHN chairman, Arnie Chapman, who has done a great job with this network of podcasts. If you would like to reach me for this show, you can email me at totalsportsrecall@gmail.com or check out my portfolio site at www.clippings.me/totalsportsrecall. This is your host, Harv Aronson, hoping you enjoyed another episode of the Total Sports Recall podcast. And until next time, I wish you well.
The contents of this podcast do not represent the opinions of others and are solely the opinions of Harv Aronson based on his experience, knowledge, and research.
Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, aka the Football History Dude, and I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history, but as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know, that can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you gotta do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you gotta do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.